First John chapter 3, verses 10 through 19 is our text. And of course, you know that the book of First John is about distinguishing true Christians from non-Christians. And by the way, there is a very great difference, I'm sure you've noticed. There's a big difference between Christians and non-Christians. You see, to be a Christian is more than just running around and telling everyone that you're a Christian. It's more than just being religious-minded. The whole world tends to be religious in some way or another. It's more than just a public profession. It's more than just reading a self-help book. It's more than just trimming off the rough edges of your life. No, to be a true Christian is to be changed by the mighty power of God, you see. That's a very great thing when God changes you. One of the great points of this book is that true Christians are born of God. That's the main theme, really, of 1 John. Christians have had a spiritual birth. God has moved in the heart and has created something new. God has created something quite different from what is found in the world. The Bible calls this a quickening in Ephesians chapter 2. It's also called a regeneration in Titus 3:5. It is a very great work in the heart of man that makes the man a different creature altogether. It gives the man new dispositions. It gives the man a new nature. Gives the man, or the man who is regenerated, is a very different kind of man than what you would find in the world of sinners. In this letter, John is teaching us what we will see in a man who has been born of God. You see, there are some effects when God comes and gives you a birth. Take a look at 1 John 2:29. We're just going to scan a few of the verses that refer to being born of him. 1 John 2:29 says, "If you know that he is righteous, you know that everyone which doeth righteousness is what? Born of him." 1 John 3:9, which we saw last week. "Whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin," that is habitually, "for his seed remaineth in him, and he cannot sin, because he is," what? Born of God. 1 John 4:7, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loveth is," what? Born of God, and knoweth God. 1 John 5:1, "Whosoever believeth that Jesus is the Christ is," what? Born of God. 1 John 5:4, "For whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world." 1 John 5:18, "We know that whosoever is born of God sinneth not." Now last week we saw that anyone who is born of God does not continue on in that sinful lifestyle. It says in 1 John 3:9, "Whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin." Anyone who has truly experienced the love of God and the grace of God in salvation will be remarkably changed. Anyone who has been born into God's family and who has become God's son will have a very strong motivation to repent of sin and to walk in a much different way. Many people in this world resist the grace of God and actually oppose the grace of God because they suppose that the sheer grace of God will give men a license to sin more. Preachers sometimes fail to preach the unmitigated grace of God for fear that the people will sit down and do nothing. They somehow think that the grace of God has a negative effect on the people. The fact of the matter is that grace has a very great positive effect on those whom God has regenerated. Grace comforts the heart. Grace infuses the heart with love. Grace will bring tears of joy down the cheeks. If you want to motivate a man to good works, then tell him about unmitigated grace, you see. The unmitigated grace of God in salvation. We saw last week that the one who is born of God does not continue on in the habitual practice of sin. And now we're going to see this morning that the one who is born of God does not hate his brother. It just makes sense, doesn't it? I think I can say this morning that if you are a hateful person, and I don't think we have any here this morning like that, but if you were, if your life is characterized by hate for others, then you have not been born by the power of God and you are not his child. I think that's what this book is saying. It's a hard saying, isn't it? Our text is introduced this morning by the last phrase of verse 10. So let's read verse 10. In this the children of God are manifest, and the children of the devil. Whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth not his brother. If you do not love your brother, then John says that you are not the child of God. It's as simple as that. In fact, if you do not love your brother, you are of the devil. This principle truth applies to all laymen in the church, you see. It applies to all teachers in the church. It applies to all deacons in the church. And it applies to all pastors in the church. It is a universal truth. If you hate your brother, then you are not born of God. So we see, first of all, that John encourages brotherly love toward one another. Look at verse 11. For this is the message that ye heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Even though brotherly love is an essential part of our new nature, and even though we certainly will exhibit this loving quality to some degree if we are born of God, it's interesting here that it's good to be encouraged in this grace. God uses teaching to enlarge and improve what he has already created in us. And so John teaches his born-again readers and encourages them to love one another. I suppose that we can always improve in our pursuit of Christian virtue. God has created the seed of love in us by our new birth. But we can improve on our love from day to day. So John says that we should love one another. John is saying this is a good thing. It's a very good thing to love one another. It is a defining thing. It is a thing to be improved upon as a sign of our Christian birth. You'll notice here that this message, that we should love one another, was the message which they had heard from the beginning. Do you see that? It seems here that John is suggesting that this is the first message for Christians. It is a primal message. Perhaps it is the most important message. It is the message which is inherent in the gospel. It is the message which Christ brought with him to this earth, and that message is that we should love one another. You remember that Christ was once asked, which was the greatest commandment? They came to Christ, which one's the greatest? There's so many of them. And he said, the greatest command was to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. And then he said, and the second is likened to it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's in Matthew chapter 22. This is the beginning of Christian virtue. This is the root of all other Christian virtues. If we love one another, we will not lie to one another, you see. If we love one another, we will not steal from one another. And so this is the message which is from the beginning, love one another. This is the message which was from the beginning in that it was the message of Christ, and it is the message of his apostles, and it is the message that is continually handed down from age to age. Those who are born again should love one another. But now we see in our text from the negative perspective that John discourages hate toward one another. Look at verse 12. Not as Cain, who was of that wicked one and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. I want you to notice here the great distinction between those who are born of God and those who are not. Those who are born of God are characterized by love for one another. But those who are not born of God are characterized by hate. You can write it down. And here we have the example of Cain. And John says, don't be like Cain, you see. Not like Cain, he says. The first thing we see about Cain in our text is that Cain was of the wicked one. Do you see that? Not as Cain, who was of that wicked one. This is the ultimate explanation of things. Why, that explains it. We are either God's children by a new birth, or we are Satan's children by our fallen nature. There is no middle ground. There is no mixture of the two. We either belong to God by regeneration, or we belong to Satan. At the end of all things, Christ is going to set one group on his right hand and one on his left hand. And this great division will be for all eternity. You know the biblical narrative regarding Cain. Cain was the firstborn son of Adam and Eve in Genesis 4:1. And I want you to see how the power of sin is passed down to the children of Adam. It didn't take 10 generations for sin to take hold. You might have thought it would have. It took hold immediately. Guilt was passed down to Cain, the very first son of Adam. And the sinful nature was passed down as well to the very first son. And the sinful nature was very powerful from the very beginning. You'll notice here that Cain murdered his brother. You might have thought that the sin nature was less severe in the beginning. You might have thought that Cain would not have had hate in his heart so early in human history, but no, the sin nature was a roaring lion from the beginning. And Cain killed his younger brother. And John says, don't be like Cain. I want you to notice the reason that Cain murdered his brother. First of all, it was out of envy. Cain looked at his brother Abel, and he saw a better person than himself. That's what it amounted to. And this is to be expected. Abel was born of God, and Cain was of the devil. And Cain watched his brother every day, and he saw that Abel was the better man. This is very glorious when you think about it. Look what God can do. You see, Cain and Abel came from the same stock, but look what God can do. Look how God creates something wonderful in the heart of Adam's second son. Abel had no natural advantage over Cain. He inherited spiritual death from Adam too. But he had a supernatural advantage, and that is that God made him alive. Abel was born of God and Cain was not. And look at the difference it makes. Abel was the better man by far because of what God did in him, and Cain was very envious. You'll notice that the better man is always evident by the better works, you see. How you gonna know? We can't necessarily look down into the heart. But the better man is always evident by the better works. You know, of course, that true religion is always of the heart. The better man loves God. The better man loves his brother. It is a matter of the heart, but then the better heart finds expression, you see, in better works. Works is just the outworking of the heart. And Abel's works were righteous, and Cain's works were evil. That's what John says. It seems that Cain recognized the difference between his works and Abel's works. And he was envious. He saw it. He recognized it. He set his own works beside his brother's works. And he said to himself, "My brother's works are better." In fact, he recognized that his brother's works were righteous and his own works were evil. You've heard of sibling rivalry, haven't you? When I take my brothers out to the golf course, I just want to beat their brains out, you see? And here we have the earliest example of it. Abel was head and shoulders taller than Cain in righteousness. And envy stirred up in the heart of Cain. Now, here is what Cain should have done. Cain should have repented of his sin. He should have exercised faith in God. But he had no capacity to do so. His sin nature was too great. He was dead in trespasses and sins, and so his envy progressed into hatred. I want you to see here how love and hate come from different sources. God says, "Love one another," but Satan says, "Hate one another." And which will it be for you, you see? If you love one another, you show that you are born of God. If you hate one another, you show that you are of the devil. Isn't that what John is saying here? And then notice how hate produces works of very great malice. Who could ever suppose that a man could murder his neighbor, much less his own brother, according to the flesh? But this is what man will do. He will kill his brother, which is an example for us. We should be careful. Sin indulged knows no bounds, you see. Little sins will become very big sins. Lies will become thefts. Envy and anger will become murder. Cain's envy of Abel became anger in his heart, and his anger became a murderous impulse, and he took Abel out into the field and he murdered him. But then I want you to see in verse 13 that John states the principle to be learned from Cain and Abel. John tells us this story of Cain to teach us a universal principle. Now, some would probably hear the story of Cain and Abel and say, "Why, I would never do that." Cain must have been an extraordinarily evil man. Cain must be the exception and not the rule. But John is telling us that Cain is not the exception. He is the rule. Marvel not, in verse 13, marvel not, my brethren, if the world hate you. You'll notice here that there are two groups in John's view in verse 13. On one hand, there are John's brethren. Who are they? Why, those that are his Christian brothers, those that are born of God. And he says, marvel not, my brethren. These are John's readers who he styles as his brethren. These are the ones that he has been describing as born of God. These are the ones whom God has changed, you see. They're the better men, if you will. These are the ones who have a different lifestyle from others. These are the ones who obey God and who do righteous works and who love one another. And then the second group is called the world, you see. This is the group who has the same old lifestyle. They are the ones who do not obey God's commands. They don't have righteous works. They don't love one another. And here's the principle. They will hate you. Marvel not, John says. Don't think it strange if they hate you. It's not a strange thing. It's what should be expected. They will see your righteous works and they will envy you and they will hate you for it. But then I want you to see in verse 14 that John establishes love for the brethren as a sign of justification. Look at verse 14. It says there, we know that we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren. He that loveth not his brother abideth in death. Now, by now, after all these years, you should know what justification is. Justification is something that happens in God's courtroom. It is a legal declaration. It is when God swings the gavel and declares that you are righteous. It is that moment when God wipes away your sins and declares that he will never impute sin to your account, according to Romans 4:8. It is that moment when God imputes righteousness to your account. And John describes justification here as that glorious moment when you passed from death to what? To life. You see, that is one way to describe it. It is that moment when you passed from death unto life. Justification is a standing. It is where you stand, you see. We all previously stood in a state of death. We stood there in it. It was the condition that we inherited from Adam. We were conceived into it, and there was no way out of it, humanly speaking. It was our hopeless condition. The Bible describes it as a state of condemnation, and John describes it as a state of death. But then God came to us and made us alive, and we believed the gospel. And at that moment, we assumed a different standing before God. We found ourselves standing in a place that John calls life. Oh my. A man was found guilty of a crime and was sentenced to death in the electric chair. As far as the state was concerned, this man stood as a criminal and he was to be put to death. He was on death row. But then new evidence was found, and this new evidence was sent to the governor's office. And after review, the governor issued a full pardon. And this pardon completely changed this man's standing with the state. The guard came to the man's cell and he said, "You now are in good standing with the state and you're free to go." And when we are justified, the guard comes to our cell and he says, "You are now in good standing with Almighty God." And in our text, John calls it passing from death to life. But how do we know that we have passed from death to life? We want to know for sure, don't we? How do we know that we've been justified? What evidence is there to prove it? Why, look what John says in verse 14. "We know that we have passed from death to life because we," what? "Love the brethren." Now, I don't know that God will allow you to take a peek into the heavenly record books. He hasn't taken me up there yet to show me my legal sheet. I don't know if an angel will appear to you and assure you of your good standing with God, but here is a sure sign. If you love the brethren, you have good standing. How is your heart disposed toward other Christians, you see? How is your heart disposed toward your fellow church members? Are you highly critical of them? Are you envious of them? Are you distrustful of them? Would you take pleasure in their downfall? Do you easily withdraw your hand of fellowship from them? Do you hold grudges against them? Do you refuse to accept them? Would you just as soon see them banned from the church? Then I would suggest to you that you have not passed from death to life. Isn't that what our scripture says? "He that loveth not his brother abideth in death." That means he's still standing in it. It seems to me here that if you fall short of loving your brothers, then you are abiding in death. Loving the brethren will be your continuous practice if you are born of God. It will be the general rule of your life. On the other hand, if you do not love the brethren, it is tantamount to hating them. And hating the brethren is a sign that you have a deadly standing before God. I can just imagine that there will be some who ask, "How much must I love the brethren? What kind of love am I required to give them anyway? How much am I asked to sacrifice for them?" So John gives us an example of the divine love in verse 16. The great example of love is the love which Christ had for us. How much did Christ love us? Why, it was this kind of love. He laid down his life for us. Jesus walked up the hill and allowed wicked men to drive nails in his hands and feet. He allowed himself to be crucified. Jesus suffered untold agonies for you and for me. This is the kind of love that Jesus had. And John tells us the kind of love that we should have for the brethren. Take a look at verse 16. It should be love in the highest degree. And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Ha ha. That's a lot of love there, isn't it? John says this is the kind of love that we ought to have for the brethren. This is the great love that we should have for one another. We ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Based on the context, this is the kind of love that will prove that we have passed from death to life. This is the kind of sacrificial love that will provide evidence that we are born of God and that we are justified in His sight. We are talking about what kind of love we are to have for the brethren, and we see next in verse 17 that it should be compassionate love. But whoso hath this world's good and seeth his brother have need and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? If we walk by someone that has a need and we have the capacity to help, but we don't help, who do you think you belong to? Do you belong to God or do you belong to the devil, you see? This is the kind of love that God has engendered in us. It's the kind that He has built in us and created in us. It's a compassionate kind of love that says, I not only see your hurt, but I'm going to help you if I can. I believe that we have much of this kind of love in our church, don't you? If you have a need, let the church know, you see, and I believe that the church is going to help you. And probably has in the past. But it also, you'll notice in verse 18, it should be a doing kind of love. John is not encouraging us here, by the way, to avoid kind and loving words. Let's read verse 18. My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. John isn't encouraging us not to have loving words and kind words. That's a good thing. They're very good. But what he is warning us against are empty words. He's warning us against words only. The real sign of love often is in the doing, isn't it? Acts of kindness are usually much more loving than mere words. I want to conclude this morning and suggest to you that loving one another is our duty. John says we ought to do it. It is the command of God. It is our duty. And if someone belongs to God through Christ, then we should love them. We should have a natural disposition toward it. It should be something that God has created in us. And so we just naturally want to love them. We naturally do love them. It seems easy to us, or should seem very easy for us to love them. It's a part of our new nature. It's a joyful thing to love them. But the main point of this passage is that it will bring you assurance if you do it. We know that we have passed from life to death if we love the brethren. You see, it's good for you. It's a way that you can know that you're justified in His sight if that grace is worked in your heart. So my encouragement to you is love one another as much as you can.